All right, let's dive in. Today, we're taking a close look at Lamentations 3.17-23, and we have Dr. Leslie Allen's work as our guide through this passage. If you haven't spent much time with Lamentations, it's a really raw book. It grapples with the aftermath of Jerusalem's destruction, back in 586 BC. And Dr. Allen points out something interesting about this section. He sees it as a kind of testimony coming from a mentor figure, and this mentor is speaking to a community that's been absolutely devastated by this event.
It's amazing how this mentor uses his own experience of suffering to connect with the congregation. They're living through the very destruction that he's describing. So his words would have carried incredible weight.
Right. It's like he's saying, I've been there. I get it. And then he goes on to explain how we made it through. And what's really interesting is verses 17 to 24. They don't just tell a story. They actually trace this mentor's journey from the depths of despair to a flicker of hope. I think that's a journey many of us can probably relate to, would you say?
Absolutely. And that first part, verses 17 to 20, it really lays bare that despair. He talks about losing peace, that sense of wholeness and well-being and happiness, not just fleeting joy, but experiencing good things in life. He even talks about losing his glory, which refers to, his life expectancy, his future prospects. It's as if everything that gave meaning to his life has been whipped away.
And he uses such powerful language to describe this, like wormwood and gall. If you ever tasted anything so bitter it makes you cringe, that's wormwood. And gall, it refers to that burning sensation of acid reflux, like your insides are on fire. They're powerful metaphors, right? Incredibly powerful.
They really give us a visceral sense of the mentor's agony. But beyond those metaphors, Dr. Allen points out a psychological term that the mentor uses, affliction and homelessness. Now, homelessness might seem a bit literal when we're talking about emotions, but think about it for a second. Have you ever felt so restless and unsettled because of grief or worry that you just couldn't find peace? That feeling of not belonging, of being adrift, that's the essence of what the mentor is conveying.
And it's not just an individual experience, is it? I mean, remember that same term, affliction and homelessness? It was used earlier in Lamentation to describe the city of Jerusalem itself. So the mentor's internal turmoil, it mirrors the ruined city around him. They're both homeless in a sense.
Exactly. And this shared experience, it's crucial. It's this deep understanding of suffering, both personal and communal, that makes the emergence of hope even more powerful. We've been immersed in the depths of the mentor's despair, but now we're about to witness a profound shift. Get ready, because a glimmer of light is about to break through.
Because in verse 21, it's like a switch flips. Dr. Allen calls this the turning time, the moment hope enters the picture. And here's the thing. He emphasizes that nothing externally has changed. The destruction is still there. But the mentor's perspective, it shifts. He chooses to focus on something different.
And that something different is huge. It's the unchanging nature of God. In verses 22 and 23, the mentor anchors his hope in those unwavering qualities of God, specifically God's steadfast love and unending mercies.
Now, we've all heard about God's love and mercy, but what makes it so significant here, especially when you consider they're living through the consequences of their disobedience? It's like, hey, God's supposed to be angry, right? Where's the wrath?
That's where the mentor's deep understanding of Scripture comes in. This isn't just wishful thinking. He's grounding his hope in core theological beliefs. That Hebrew concept of hesed, often translated as steadfast love, it isn't just about affection. It's about covenant loyalty, God's unwavering commitment to his people, even in the midst of punishment. Imagine a deep friendship where you know that no matter what you do, the other person will always be there for you. That's the kind of love the mentor is clinging to.
So even though God is disciplining them, his fundamental nature, his hesed, hasn't changed. It's like those qualities of love and mercy, they become a lifeline, something to grab onto when everything else feels lost.
Precisely. And notice how the mentor emphasizes that God's mercies are new every morning. This isn't some abstract concept. It's tied to his very survival. He wakes up each day and sees it as a fresh act of grace, a sign that God isn't done with him yet.
Each sunrise is a new beginning, a tiny spark of hope in the darkness. But he doesn't stop there, does he?
No, he doesn't. And that's where things get even more interesting, because the mentor moves from reflecting on these theological concepts to a direct personal encounter with God. We'll explore this shift in the next part of our deep dive.
We left off with that image of the mentor clinging to God's heads, that steadfast love, as a lifeline. It's not just an idea for him, though, is it?
No, not at all. There's this really powerful shift in verse 23. The mentor goes from talking about God to talking to God. He moves from his mercies never come to an end to Great is your faithfulness. It's a direct address. Like, he's moved from thinking about these things to praying about them.
It's like those moments when we cry out to God, you know, not with fancy words, but just raw emotion, holding on to faith even when we don't understand what's happening. It's like, you say, God, I don't get it, but I'm holding on to you.
And that honesty is what makes this passage so relatable, even today. We've all been there, right? Life throws us a curveball, things fall apart, and we're left grappling with despair.
Absolutely. Those moments when we feel lost and alone, questioning everything. But what strikes me is that the mentor doesn't offer those easy answers or platitudes. He doesn't say, just have faith and everything will be fine. Instead, he shows us that messy process of finding hope, even when things are really tough.
And that's an important point. He doesn't deny the pain or pretend that everything is okay. He chooses to focus on something bigger than himself, something that transcends his circumstances.
And for him, that's the unchanging character of God. But it could be anything, really. Anything that gives us a sense of meaning and purpose when everything else feels like it's falling apart. Family, a passion project, a belief in a better future. It's about finding that anchor in the storm.
Exactly. The mentor showing us that even when we can't see the way forward, we can trust in something beyond ourselves, something that gives us hope.
But this isn't just about the mentor's personal journey, right? Dr. Allen points out that this shift in his perspective has implications for the whole community.
That's right. This isn't just a self-help pep talk. It's laying the groundwork for a collective response to their crisis.
So his individual hope sparks something bigger.
Precisely. And once again, that foundation for collective hope is the enduring character of God. The mentor realizes that God's steadfast love and mercy are still available, and this becomes a shared foundation for moving forward.
It's like he's saying, hey, I found hope here. You can too. And if we hold on to this together, maybe we can rebuild.
That's the core of it. It's not about ignoring the pain and loss. It's about choosing to believe that something good can still emerge.
And that idea of something good, of a future beyond the crisis, is tied to survival, isn't it?
Absolutely. Dr. Allen highlights this beautifully. The mentor's realization that he's still alive becomes a rallying cry. It's not just breathing. It's about the potential for something new.
It's like that moment when you realize you've survived something terrible. And you think, okay, I'm still here. What now?
Right. And for this community, facing the destruction of everything they knew, that what now was a daunting question. But the mentor offers a path forward. He points them back to God's faithfulness, reminding them that even in judgment, there's mercy.
It's a powerful message, especially for those who might be feeling overwhelmed by guilt and despair. It's like he's saying, we messed up, but we're still here. God isn't finished with us yet.
And that's where a call to action comes in. He doesn't just leave them with hope. He challenges them to do something with it.
We talked about that earlier, that provocative question the mentor asks. Why should any who draw breath complain about the punishment of their sins? That's a pretty bold statement.
It is, but it's also a call to responsibility. He's challenging them to shift their focus from complaining to taking action.
So it's not about passively accepting their fate. It's about actively rebuilding.
Exactly. And here's where the mentor's personal transformation becomes a model. He's not just talking about hope. He's embodying it. He's taking his own struggle and turning it into a catalyst for healing.
It's like he's showing them that hope isn't just a feeling. It's a choice. A choice to look beyond the present and believe in a better future.
And that choice, that active embrace of hope, is what empowers them to move forward, to rebuild their lives, their community, their relationship with God.
So powerful. This deep dive isn't over yet, though. In the next part, we'll explore how this individual hope becomes a catalyst for collective healing, and ultimately, how it leads to a renewed sense of purpose for the whole community. We've been following this mentor's path from despair to hope, you know, in Lamentations 3. He started feeling completely lost and ended up finding that little glimmer of possibility in the ruins. But how does this affect the people he's speaking to? How does his own experience become something they can all share?
That's the important question, isn't it? And Dr. Allen suggests that this shift towards hope isn't just, you know, a personal pep talk. It's actually setting the stage for a communal response to this crisis they're all facing together.
So it's like his personal transformation starts something bigger, a kind of ripple effect that spreads through the community.
Exactly. And the foundation for this collective hope, well, it's that enduring character of God again. The mentor realizes God's steadfast love and mercy are still there, even after everything that's happened. And this becomes a shared foundation for moving forward.
So he's saying, look, I found hope in this. You can too. And if we all hold on to this together, well, maybe we can rebuild.
That's the heart of it. It's not about pretending the pain and loss aren't real. It's about choosing to believe something good can still come out of this.
And this idea of something good, of a future beyond the crisis, It's connected to survival, isn't it?
Absolutely. Dr. Allen really emphasizes this. The mentor, realizing he's still alive, it becomes this rallying cry. It's not just breathing, it's recognizing the potential for something new.
It's like that moment, you know, when you realize you've made it through something awful and you think, okay, I'm still here. What now?
Right. And for this community, with everything they knew destroyed, that what now was a really scary question. But the mentor offers a way forward. He points them back to God's faithfulness, reminding them that even in judgment, there's mercy.
That's a powerful message, especially for those who might be feeling crushed by guilt and despair. It's like he's saying, yeah, we messed up, but we're still here. God's not done with us yet.
And that's where the call to action comes in. He doesn't just give them hope. He challenges them to do something with it.
We talked about that earlier, that challenging question he asks. Why should any who draw breath complain about the punishment of their sins? It's a bold statement, for sure.
It is, but it's also about responsibility. He's challenging them to shift their focus from complaining to taking action.
So it's not about just accepting things, but actively working to rebuild.
Exactly. And this is where the mentor's personal change becomes an example. He doesn't just talk about hope. He lives it. He takes his own struggles and turns them into something that can help everyone heal.
It's like he's showing them that hope isn't just a feeling. It's a choice. A choice to look past what's happening now and believe in a bigger future.
And that choice, that decision to embrace hope, is what lets them move forward, to rebuild their lives, their community, their connection with God.
So what can we take away from this ancient story about suffering and hope today?
Well, I think there are a few important things to remember. First, even in the midst of pain and loss, God's love and mercy are still there. It's like knowing that even when we hit rock bottom, there's something solid beneath us, something we can build on.
It's comforting to know we're not alone in our struggles. That even when we feel overwhelmed, there's a source of strength and hope we can turn to.
Absolutely. And second, this passage pushes us to change our perspective, to actively search for signs of hope even when things seem dark. It's a reminder that hope isn't about ignoring our pain, but choosing to focus on something larger than ourselves.
It's about finding that anchor in the storm, the thing that gives us meaning when everything else feels lost.
Exactly. And lastly, I think this encourages us to put that hope into action, to take that spark of possibility and let it fuel our efforts to rebuild, to heal, to create good in the world, even if it's just starting with ourselves.
So it's not just about feeling hopeful. It's about doing something with that hope, making a difference in our own lives and the lives of those around us.
Beautifully put. I think that's a great place to wrap up. This mentor's journey in Lamentations 3, it's not just an old story. It's a timeless message of hope and resilience that can inspire us today.
We've explored the depths of despair, but we've also seen how strong God's love is and how resilient the human spirit can be. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a bit more hopeful myself.
Me too. It's a gift worth holding on to.
And that's all for this deep dive. Until next time, keep searching for those sparks of hope wherever you might find them.